Good afternoon. I think it was probably already mentioned, but I want to say happy Thanksgiving to all of you. I know that we're all thankful for many things, but the one thing that I know that we all have in common that we're all thankful for is the fact that we've been called to be first fruits. That's an incredible thing to even think about. When you and I consider what this means, we are amazed, and we should be amazed, that God, both Father and Son, want us to be just like them. This is amazing. They want us to be with them forever as members of their family, helping them to rule over the universe for eternity. Now, if that doesn't make you thankful, nothing will make you thankful. I mean, that's something to really think about. This is incredible, and it makes us realize that they see something in us that we can only dimly perceive. Please turn to Isaiah 55. They see something in us that we only dimly perceive. Let's start reading in Isaiah 55 at verse 1. Ho, that means hi there, everybody. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come buy and eat. That's sort of a contradiction. You don't have any money, but come on, buy and eat. Yes, come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend money for what is not bread? And your wages for what does not satisfy? And then God, you know, through Isaiah says, listen carefully to me and eat what is good and let your soul delight itself in abundance. Incline your ear and come to me. Hear and your soul shall live. And I, this is God speaking, I will make an everlasting covenant with you, the sure mercies of David. Indeed, I have given him, David, as a witness to the people, a leader and a commander for the people. And then the thought changes a little bit. Surely you shall call a nation you do not know, and nations who do not know you shall run to you because of the Eternal, your God, the Holy One of Israel. For he has glorified, who has he glorified? For he has glorified you. I want you to think about that because, you know, we're here and we're reading God's word and we're looking at each other. But what does God's word say? It says, he has glorified you. How do you feel? Pretty good? Are you glorified yet? Maybe that would be the good question to ask. Are you glorified yet? Well, I don't, you know, my back hurts every once in a while. I don't think I'm glorified yet. Seek the Eternal while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Eternal and he will have mercy on him. And to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Verse 8, and this one's important. For my thoughts, this is God speaking, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Brethren, we do not think as God thinks. But daily we should be learning, we should be changing, we should be trying to get a little bit more into the way that God thinks. Today I want us to see in our mind's eye a comparison between what humans think is awesome, grand, and beautiful, and what God, both Father and Son, think is awesome, grand, and beautiful. But remember Isaiah 55:8. God's thoughts are not yet quite our thoughts. Now, Suzanne and I had the opportunity, we have had the opportunity to attend God's Feast of Tabernacles 6 times in Europe. 3 of those times were in Italy. And when you're a tourist in Europe, and we were tourists in Europe, you visit cathedrals. They were built to glorify God. Nobody doubts this. And by most human standards, the sights we saw were astounding. I mean, remember last week I told you about that organ with 17,000 pipes? And they were shiny. They kept those things shined up. You know, they were really nice. Those pipes were polished, and the organ itself was in the top of the cathedral. So, you know, if you're in the front of the church, it's toward the back, but you would look up, and it shone up high near the ceiling like the sun. I mean, when the light was on it, it was impressive. And the frescoes and the paintings in all of those cathedrals were done by men to elevate the eyes and the minds of, and I was listening to Mr. Gardenhire speak, it was done to elevate the eyes and the minds of simple peasant people, many of whom couldn't read or write any language. I mean, they drew the pictures in those cathedrals because they wanted, you know, the people to look up and to think about the stories of the Bible. They couldn't read, so they had to look at the pictures. Nobody doubts that they make you look. But what is inside of those churches? What's really inside? Well, each Roman Catholic church is required to have some saints' relics inside the church, or it can't be a real church. And I'd like to ask, well, what are relics? What are relics? They are a part of the body of the so-called saint. That's what relics are. They are dead men's bones, you know, kind of put it in a crude way. In many of the cathedrals, there are sarcophaguses, I had to practice saying that word, which are boxes made of glass that you can actually see inside the body of the saint. And some of them are in various states of devolution. They're falling apart. You know, you can see the bodies in some of them. They're preserved. Now, I don't know how they did that. Probably like the body of Lenin, you know, in St. Petersburg for a long time. They didn't let it decompose. But a lot of them are just bones, you know. You can see in their bones. But they have them there on display. In St. Peter's is a human skeleton that has been arranged so that the bones, the ulna and the radius of the arm, are actually the hinge on the door. I mean, they got this thing set up just like the hinges on our door here, but these are actually a real skeleton, and the door, you know, the arm moves. William pointed that out to me on one of the trips that he made with us. He wasn't with us in Italy this year, but he said, "Dad, that's kind of cool. Look at that. That's a dead guy up there, and his bones make the door work." And I went, "You know, you're right." Now, anyway, it's very creative, very interesting. But is it God's idea of beauty? I personally think not. Bones are to be buried or burned. And when the first resurrection occurs, those honored to be in the first resurrection will be given spirit bodies. Those in the second resurrection will be given fresh, new physical bodies. Those who have been designated and judged contemptible and deserving of the third resurrection and the lake of fire will be given papier-mâché bodies. You know, God is not looking forward to their suffering, and they're not going to be around very long, but they will be eliminated. Whoever God judges needs to be eliminated will be. God does not need bones to reassemble us. God does not need anything physical, but we shall see bones coming together because it says we will in Ezekiel 36 and 37. You know, you go there and you read it, and it appears to my mind to be something that's really going on and happening. St. Peter's Basilica is huge. It's over 2 football fields long. You could play, I want you to listen to this, football weekend, you could play 2 NFL games inside St. Peter at the same time and still have enough room for a 50,000 seat area for the people to watch at this game and a 50,000 seat place for the people to watch that game. That's how big it is. Over 650 feet long and over 450 feet high. You know, when you talk about the Colosseums of the world or even the Astrodome, you know, in Houston, I watched them play last week, you know, on Thursday, Thanksgiving, when you look at those, you could have 100,000 people in there watching 2 NFL games at the same time. It's huge. If you're not impressed by big, you know, you're not impressed by anything. I mean, it's big. But I ask, it was built to honor God, but which God does it honor? Remember my point. God does not think as we do. Please turn to 2 Samuel 7. We will turn to 2 Samuel 7. David will be king, at least one of the kings under Jesus Christ, but David needed to be reminded of something. Let's start at verse 1 in 2 Samuel 7. Now it came to pass when the king, that's David, was dwelling in his house, and the Eternal had given him rest from all his enemies all around, that the king said to Nathan the prophet. Nathan was a rather famous prophet. There were other prophets, but Nathan was kind of a big name guy at the time. David said to Nathan, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells inside tent curtains." Then Nathan said to the king, and you kind of get the feeling here that Nathan knew who he worked for, because look at what Nathan says to the king. "Go, do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you." You know, Nathan just kind of said that right off the top of his head. Didn't kneel down, didn't ask God. But, you know, he just said it right off the top. But it did happen that night that the word of the Lord came to Nathan saying, oh, well, Nathan didn't call on God, but God called on Nathan. And he said, "Go and tell my servant David, thus says the Eternal, would you build a house for me to dwell in? For I have not dwelt in a house since the time that I brought the children of Israel up from Egypt, even to this day, but have moved about in a tent and in a tabernacle. Wherever I have moved about with all the children of Israel, have I ever spoken a word to anyone from the tribes of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Have I ever said that?" No, God never said that. Yet, notice verse 8 and 9. "Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Eternal of hosts, I took you from the sheepfold, from following the sheep, to be a ruler over my people, over Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you, and have made you a great name like the name of the great men who are on the earth. I've been with you. I've made your name great. But I haven't asked you to build me a house of cedar. And cedar is a really good word. If Walt was here, we could talk to him about how good cedar is. The Eternal was content to dwell with the Israelites in the very portable tabernacle. But God doesn't think as we humans do. On the other hand, God understands how we think. And they, both Father and Son, make concessions to our obsession with physical beauty and grandeur. 2 Samuel 7, verse 12. God goes on, he's talking to Nathan, and Nathan's going to talk to David. God goes on to say, "When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." Just a sidebar here. Forever is still going on. The kingdom, the throne that the Eternal established in David and in Solomon after him, that throne still exists on this earth today. That was a sidebar. I go on. Solomon built a beautiful temple. It was ornate. It was relatively big in a small way. 90 feet tall. That's tall. But it was relatively small when you compare the, Hanging Gardens of Babylon or the pyramids or, some of those things. But it was nice. It was decorated with pomegranates. We all need to wonder why God chose pomegranates to run all over and through the temple. I wonder. And the temple was beautiful, but it is not what God really cares about. If God really cared that much about the first temple, it would never have been destroyed. God thinks differently than people. 2 Samuel 7, verse 10. "Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more. Nor shall the sons of wickedness oppress them any more as previously." Something going on there that's not immediately obvious to us. Verse 11, "And will not oppress them any more as previously since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people and have caused you, David, to rest from all your enemies." Also, the Eternal tells you that He, the Eternal, will make you a house. Not Solomon, not David, not any physical person. The Eternal will make you a house. I kind of like that. God knows how to build. Now, in those two verses, 10 and 11, the word house has a double or even a triple meaning. And you have to really get into that, and I don't have time to do that right now. But we know that God gave the promised land to Israel, to physical Israel. And the Jews today tell everyone that that chunk of real estate is theirs. They're not going to move. And they will tell anybody, this land is our land. But is that all that's meant by 2 Samuel 7, verse 10? Shall the sons of wickedness oppress them anymore? God told Nathan to tell David, no more oppression. I contend that the Jews in Israel are oppressed by their neighbors, especially every time a Katyusha rocket falls near a Jew's home. That oppression is still going on. My point is that besides the Jews moving and staying in the modern nation of Israel, besides the fact that the Israelite royalty sits on the throne of England, God is alluding to even more in 2 Samuel 7, verse 10. And now we need to leap into the future and see what that allusion is. So, turn to the back of your Bibles. Let's go to Revelation 21. Revelation 21 just falls open there in the back. Revelation 21, and let's read verse 1. Now I saw, John is speaking, he was given a vision. Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. John was given a vision of something that he as a human had a hard time describing. Verse 1 has been interpreted by others in several ways, and I don't want to do that today. But I do call your attention to the fact that whatever he saw was very different. God thinks differently than we do. Peter was inspired to add something to what John was saying. Let's go to 2 Peter. You just turn back a little bit, just about, 10 pages. 2 Peter 3, and we'll read verse 10, which is related. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise. Wow. And the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. This has been called by some the longest time interval verse in the Bible, because it starts with the day of the Lord and it ends with the new heavens and the new earth. Conservatively speaking, that's at least 1,100 years in one verse. But the point is, elements will melt. Now, I don't know how much training in physics John had, but he wrote the words, in whatever language you want to look at it, the elements will melt. There will be a change in physics and in the chemical makeup of physical objects. God is going to change not the way we look at things, but the way things are that we look at. I'll read that again. God's going to change not the way we look at things, but the way things are that we humans look at. Now back to Revelation 21. I'll read verse 1 again. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth has passed away, and there was no more sea. And then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. God uses that comparison often. Why? Why is he always talking about a bride prepared for a husband? Because there is a reality coming. There is a reality coming. God's church, God's people, you and me, are going to marry Jesus Christ. This is a very strange concept for all of us males. For the women, they can get their minds around it. They can see that, marrying Jesus Christ. It makes sense. But for us guys, we have to strain a bit to think of ourselves as the bride of Jesus Christ. So God had John write Revelation 21. It helps us a little bit. Look at verse 3. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God." This thing comes down from heaven and a loud voice says, "Behold the tabernacle." What is a tabernacle anyway? What is a tabernacle? Didn't I kind of mention tabernacles when I first got going here? Yeah, isn't this where we started? In the wilderness, God's presence was indicated by this box on poles that the Levites carried all over creation. It was a nice box, but it was just a box. That's what it was. It was a box. God God doesn't live in a box or in a tent. God inhabits eternity. They, both Father and Son, can't be boxed in. But because they, the Father and Son, understand people like us, the Eternal allowed His presence to be visibly seen as a cloud above this box in the wilderness. And the Eternal was not ashamed to be seen in such a humble, non-human, non-representational way. God doesn't think like humans. Revelation 21:5. Then He who sat on the throne said, "Behold, I make all things new." And He said to me, write this down, for these words are true and faithful. Behold, I make all things new. Brethren, I want to tie together now the tent in the wilderness, the first and second temples, and us. God designed the tabernacle in the wilderness and gave exact directions of how to build it and with what materials. It was a very nice box. God did the same with the first temple. It was beautiful. If you wish to see a computer-assisted rendering of that temple and its beauty, you can do so through Sandy Beatty, who's not here today, who with his wife Monica have put together the temple online so that anyone with a computer can see a pretty good rendering of what that first temple looked like. God allowed that first temple to be desecrated, destroyed, and replaced by the second temple. Why? Because God doesn't think like us, and because God is building another temple. Also, God does not like the temples that man designs and builds for pagan idols. Please turn now to 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians 6. Corinthians 6, and I'm going to read just two verses. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 15. Paul says, "What accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people." This is not a metaphor. This is not a metaphor. You know, we talk about metaphors all the time. They help us understand reality. This is not a metaphor. This is the reality. This is the reality. The third and final temple that God intends is us. He intends it to be us. Go to 1 Corinthians now, turning back to 1 Corinthians 3. Once again, I'm going to read two verses. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 16 and 17. "Do you not know that you are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, which temple you are." I know I'm cherry picking those verses, and I'm reading them without the entire context, but I believe completely that I am sharing with you what God wants us to understand about those two places in Corinthians. God, both Father and Son, intend us to be the eternal third and final temple. It's quite an honor, of course, but it is also a magnificent plan that fully demonstrates the power and the glory of God. We don't see things as God does, but we can be changed. And we can begin to grow in grace and knowledge. We need to try harder to think like God. Let's turn to 2 Peter 3 again to help us conclude. 2 Peter 3, you know, and I'm sure that Peter was straining as hard as John was to understand these things that, you know, that he was told to write. It's not easy to understand. 2 Peter 3, let's read verse 11. Peter says, "Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved," and he's talking about everything in heaven, everything on earth, everything that is a thing, "since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of person ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness?" God thinks differently than we do. We need to try to be more like God. Verse 12, "looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat." Since this is going to happen, what kind of people do we need to be? Verse 13, "nevertheless," you know, Peter kind of gulps and says, "nevertheless, we, according to his promise, we look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells." New heavens, new earth, new elements, full of righteousness, the righteousness of God. Let's go to Revelation 21 again. One last time. Revelation 21, I'm going to read verse 2 again. "Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." And then go to verse 22. "But I saw no temple in it, for the Lord Almighty and the Lamb are its temple." God does not dwell in temples. God is the temple. The Father, the Lamb, and us.